WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Kylie Worth with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, August 1st. For the first time in 8 years, the city of Sarasota is considering an increase in property tax rates. That's because last year, Sarasota spent $15 million, about half of its reserves, to deal with the fallout of last year's hurricane season. The proposed budget would raise the property tax rate from 3.0 to 3.3 mils, helping Sarasota build up an additional $5 million in reserves. There are also some uncertainties with this coming year's federal funding. At this week's budget workshops, the city said it would be going into the next fiscal year under the assumption it will be receiving no funding from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the same agency that has received widespread criticism for its response to the Texas floods. Without this increase to property tax rates, it's possible Sarasota's reserves could fall below $10 million. The University of South Florida has approved an increase to their out-of-state tuition. This is the first tuition hike in over a decade. The plan was unanimously approved by the USF Board of Trustees, and it also applies to the Sarasota Manatee campus. Beginning next fall, out-of-state students will owe an extra $35 per credit hour. Depending on the number of credits the student chooses to take, it's possible their tuition could be raised an additional $1,000 per year. USF isn't the first Florida school to raise their out-of-state tuition. The University of Florida, Florida State University, Florida International University, Florida A&M University, and the University of Central Florida have all approved an increase to their out-of-state tuition. Starting today, all hurricane supplies will be permanently tax-free. This includes batteries, carbon monoxide alarms, portable chargers, life jackets, and other items one might find in a hurricane supply kit. This permanent tax exemption comes from Governor Ron DeSantis' last budget approval. Included in this budget is the extension of the back-to-school tax holiday, which will now run throughout the entire month of August. This will give consumers an entire month, as opposed to a week-long, of tax-free school supplies. This has been Kylie Worth with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, August 1st.
The following program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini, and thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. I suppose it should be no huge surprise that now Duke University and its law school have come under fire by the administration of he who would be king for some vague assertions of race-related discrimination. The very idea that the university attempted to broaden the makeup of its law school journal staff to include members of all races and nationalities was at its core discriminatory against white people, according to the administration, and they should be punished. So, as we have seen with Columbia, the first victim who has capitulated, and then Harvard, who tried to push back but is making a deal, Duke is being threatened with losing its federal funding if it doesn't give in to the perverse manipulation of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that prohibits discrimination on the grounds of race in education programs receiving federal funding. Of course, the DEI policies being cited were a way to address historical inequities against marginalized groups such as ethnic minorities, not a method of limiting the participation of white people, who history shows have done just fine. Stay tuned until about half past the hour to hear my conversation with Daria Manovi, a senior analyst for the Center of Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists, who will discuss her recent report detailing the 400 times so far the Trump administration has hamstrung science in America. But first, replacing his name will not make Trump equal to John F. Kennedy or cause anyone to forget how great a president he was. A House Republicans bill would strip former President Kennedy's name from the Washington Institution, created in the 35th Commander-in-Chief's honor, and instead have it be known as the Trump Center for the Performing Arts. The bill, recently introduced by Rep. Bob Ondor, Republican from Montana, claims to designate the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts as the Donald J. Trump Center for the Performing Arts. Representatives for Ondor and the Kennedy Center did not immediately return ITEC's request for comment about the proposed name change. In an earlier statement, Ondor called Trump a patron of the arts and a staple of the pop culture landscape, dubbing the bill the Make Entertainment Great Again Act, a play on Trump's 2016 presidential campaign slogan, Make America Great Again. Ondor said, "I cannot think of a more ubiquitous symbol of American exceptionalism in the arts, entertainment, and populist culture at large than President Trump." House Republicans on the Appropriations Committee approved an amendment earlier this month to the Interior, Environment, and Related Agencies annual spending bill that would rename a space inside the Kennedy Center, the prominent Washington Arts Hub's famed opera house, the First Lady Melania Trump Opera House. Rep. Mike Simpson, a Republican from Idaho, called the potential Opera House designation an excellent way to recognize Melania Trump's support and commitment to promoting the arts. The Opera House amendment was met with fierce condemnation from Trump critics, including Jack Schlossenberg Kennedy, Kennedy's 32-year-old grandson. A nation reveals itself not only in the men it produces, but also the men it honors, the men it remembers, Schlossberg wrote in a social media post. The Trump administration stands for freedom of oppression, not expression, Schlossberg said. Trump, in an unprecedented move, overhauled the Kennedy Center's board, named himself the chair in February, accusing it of being too woke. After touring the Kennedy Center in March, Trump said that it was in a state of tremendous disrepair. "We're going to fix it up, but it's really emblematic of our country," Trump said at the time. The Kennedy Center opened its doors to the public in 1971. It described its namesake, Kennedy, on its website as a lifelong supporter and advocate of the arts who frequently steered the public discourse towards what he called our contribution to the human spirit. According to the institution, 2 months after Kennedy's 1963 assassination, Congress passed and President Johnson signed into law legislation naming the National Cultural Center as a living memory to Kennedy. Since Trump is such a big supporter of the arts, he should appreciate his featured appearance in the latest episode of South Park. Art of Donald Trump's portrayal in the latest season of South Park has appeared on the streets of California. The images of the mural were captured in Los Angeles a week after Trump was depicted as lying in bed with the devil, sparking a swift response from the White House. Newsweek contacted the White House for comment on the situation via email. South Park returned for its 27th season after 2.5-year hiatus with an episode that satirized President Trump in a series of provocative scenarios, including lying in a bed with Satan, arguing with the Canadian Prime Minister. The episode, titled Sermon on the Mount, also referenced the so-called Epstein List, an alleged list of clients involved in Jeffrey Epstein's crimes. The Department of Justice and FBI have said no incriminating client list exists. The art was captured on Sunday when passersby noted that images of Trump and Satan in bed together had appeared on a sidewalk in Los Angeles. The art appears to be from muralist Rod Benson, who posted the mural to his Instagram on Saturday, where it quickly amassed over 10,000 likes. The episode aired one day after the Federal Communications Commission approved a major Paramount Global Skydance Media merger, and just weeks after Paramount settled a $16 million lawsuit from President Trump related to a CBS interview with Kamala Harris. So far, President Trump has not personally commented on the episode, but White House issued a robust response on his behalf. Shortly after the episode aired, White House spokesperson Taylor Rogers told Rolling Stone on July 24th, "The left's hypocrisy truly has no end. For years, they have come after South Park for what they labeled as offensive content, but suddenly they're praising the show. Just like the creators of South Park, the left has no authentic or original content, which is why their popularity continues to hit record lows. This show hasn't been relevant for over 20 years and is hanging on by a thread with uninspired ideas and desperate attempt for attention. President Trump has delivered on more promises in just 6 months than any other president in our country's history, and so no fourth-rate show can derail President Trump's hot streak." In response to the statement, South Park co-creator Trey Parker, during a panel at Comic-Con International in San Diego, offered a mock-serious reaction. "We're terribly sorry," he said. When asked about the Trump administration's reaction to the episode, Parker explained that their decision not to blur certain content in the episode was intentional and in keeping with the show's satirical style. David S. Korzenek, a veteran media lawyer, told South Park, "There's no real possibility of any credible legal peril. Any lawsuit against South Park for this would be ridiculous." Marjorie Hines, a First Amendment lawsuit lawyer and author, told Newsweek, "The South Park show is obviously satire, not an assertion of fact, so under the law as it stands, the satire is fully protected by the First Amendment." Paramount and South Park creators are expected to continue producing new episodes as part of their long-term deal, despite White House criticism. Pennies are on their way out. Now, that was a problem that really needed to be fixed. Republican lawmakers in Congress are forging ahead with President Donald Trump's plan to end the production of pennies, a move that could potentially cost jobs and affect the way businesses handle cash transactions. The House Financial Services Committee, which oversees banking, insurance, and other related matters, advanced a bill dubbed the Common Sense Act by a vote of 35-13 on July 23rd. The bill would formalize Trump's February order directing the Treasury Department to halt penny production and round cash transactions to the nearest 5 cents. It was introduced by Rep. Lisa McClain, Republican from Michigan, Rep. Robert Garcia, a Democrat from California, Senator Cynthia Lummins, Republican from Wyoming, and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a Democrat from New York, in April. The Common Sense Act is about fiscal responsibility and good government, McClain, the House Republican Conference Chairwoman, said in a statement. Taxpayers shouldn't be footing the bill to produce a coin that loses money every time it's made. It's time to modernize our currency policy. Trump has previously deemed the 1 cent coins as wasteful, arguing that it's pricey to make them. The 2024 annual report from the United States Mint found that the cost of making a penny was 3.69 cents. Rep. John Rose, Republican from Tennessee, who sits on the House Financial Services Committee, originally expressed concerns over the Common Sense Act, but later supported the initiative. Tennessee is home to the sole manufacturer of penny blanks, which are flat metal discs that eventually become coins, according to the U.S. Mint. Kevin Morrison, the mayor of Greene County, Tennessee, where the blanks are produced, argued that ending production would cost individuals their jobs. In a House Financial Services Committee markup on July 23rd, Rose argued that eliminating the penny without a well-crafted plan to phase out the 1 cent coin won't accomplish the goal of improving the cost and efficiency of U.S. currency. As it stands, there's been no time provided for states, retailers, or consumers to prepare for a penniless economy, he said. We need to do that responsibly and thoughtfully. However, Rose ultimately said that he would vote in favor of the act after getting reassurances from his colleagues that his concerns would be addressed. The influential House Rules Committee, which sets terms of how a bill will be debated on, amended, and voted on by members in the lower chamber, must take up the bill next. The bill does face an uphill battle in the Senate, however, as 7 Democrats will need to join Republicans in breaking the 60-vote threshold and advancing it to the final vote, assuming all Republicans support the bill. Republicans have a 53-seat majority in the upper chamber. The government made its final order of penny blanks in May, the first step to ending production of the coin, a spokesperson from the Treasury Department said. The United States Mint will continue to manufacture pennies while an inventory of penny blanks exists, the spokesperson said at this time. It is unclear when the inventory will run out. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. The UK is backing the recognition of Palestine. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer has said the UK will recognize a Palestinian state in September, unless Israel takes substantive steps to end the appalling situation in Gaza, as well as meeting other conditions. I have always said that we will recognize a Palestinian state as a contribution to proper peace process at the moment of maximum impact for the two-state solution, Starmer said in a press briefing after a cabinet meeting on Tuesday. I can confirm the UK will recognize the state of Palestine by the United Nations General Assembly in September, unless the Israeli government takes substantive steps to end the appalling situation in Gaza, agree to a ceasefire, and commit to a long-term sustainable peace, reviving the prospect of a two-state solution. Starmer convened the meeting one day after the UK leader said the British public are revolted by images of people starving in Gaza, speaking alongside U.S. President Donald Trump in Scotland. Starmer has been facing mounting pressure from within his own Labour Party to take a tougher line on Israel, made more acute after French President Emmanuel Macron's recent announcement that France would recognize a Palestinian state in September, becoming the first G7 country to do so. Democrats in Congress are imploring Republicans in control to do something about the tragic suffering in Gaza. Senate Democrats are imploring President Donald Trump's administration to step up its role in addressing suffering and starvation in Gaza, with more than 40 senators signing on to a letter this week urging the resumption of ceasefire talks and sharply criticizing an Israeli-backed American organization that has been created to distribute food aid. In a letter to Secretary of State Marco Rubio and the Republican President's Special Envoy Steve Witkoff, the senators said the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, created in February with backing from the Trump administration, has failed to address the deepening humanitarian crisis and contributed to an unacceptable and mounting civilian death toll around the organization's sites. It marked a mostly united plea from Senate Democrats who are locked out of power in Washington for the Washington administration to recalibrate its approach after the collapse of a ceasefire talks last week. Trump Monday broke with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, saying he wanted him to make sure they get the food in Gaza and referencing the images of the hungry children. Trump this week said that the U.S. would set up food centers to address the worsening humanitarian crisis, but he did not offer any details. White House spokeswoman Anna Kelly followed up with a statement that said details would be forthcoming and that Trump wants to alleviate suffering for the people of Gaza because he is a humanitarian. He has a humanitarian heart. The White House and the State Department on Tuesday still had no information about plans for food centers. Democratic Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii said it was not at all credible to think that the Israeli military, one of the most advanced in the world, is incapable of distributing food aid or performing crowd control. They made a choice to establish a new way of doing food distribution, he said, and it's not working at all. The letter obtained by the Associated Press calls for a large-scale expansion of aid into Gaza, channeled through organizations experienced working in the area. It also says efforts for ceasefire agreement are as critical and urgent as ever. The message was led by four Jewish members of the Democratic Caucus, Senators Adam Schiff of California, Chuck Schumer of New York, Jackie Rosen of Nevada, and Schatz, and call for the return of the roughly 50 hostages, 20 still believed to be alive, held by Hamas since October 7th, 2023 attack. The signatures from the 44 senators, the vast majority of the Senate Democratic Caucus, on a letter show the extent to which Democrats have achieved some unity on foreign policy issue that deeply divided them while they held the White House last year. They called for an end to the war that sees Hamas no longer in control of Gaza and a long-term goal of both an Israeli and Palestinian state and opposed to any permanent displacement of the Palestinian people. Meanwhile, Republicans are backing Trump's handling of the situation and supporting Israel. Senator John Cronin, a Texas Republican who sits on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said he was satisfied with Trump trying to referee that the Israelis need to get their hostages back. Still, images of the worsening hunger crisis in Gaza seem to be reaching some Republican members of Congress. Over the weekend, far-right Rep. Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, who routinely calls for an end to foreign aid, said on social media, "What is happening to innocent people and children in Gaza is horrific. This war and humanitarian crisis must end." For Schatz, it's a sign that many Americans do care about the suffering in other parts of the world, even after Trump won the election with a America First foreign policy goals and kickstarted his administration by demolishing USAID programs. Jobs are diminishing. Wait till the tariffs really kick in. Employers posted 7.4 million job vacancies last month, a sign that American job market continues to cool. The Labor Department reported this week that job openings in June were down from 7.7 million in May and were about what forecasters had expected. The job openings and labor turnover survey jolts showed that layoffs were a little changed in June, but the number of people quitting their jobs, a sign of confidence in their prospects elsewhere, dropped last month to the lowest level since December. Hiring also fell from May. Posting on Blue Sky, Glassdoor economist Daniel Zhao wrote that the report shows softer figures with hires and quits rates still sluggish. Not dire, not amazing, more meh. The U.S. job market has lost momentum this year, partly because of the lingering effects of the 11% rate hikes by the inflation fighters at the Federal Reserve in 2022 and 2023, and partly because President Donald Trump's trade wars have created uncertainty that is paralyzing managers making hiring decisions. Last week, the Labor Department will put out, unemployment and hiring numbers for July. They are expected to show that unemployment rate ticked up to a still low 4.2% in July from 4.1% in June. Businesses, government agencies, and nonprofits are expected to have added 115,000 jobs in July, down from 147,000 in June, according to a survey of economists by the data firm FactSet. The seemingly decent June hiring figures were weaker than they appeared. Private payrolls rose just 74,000 in June, fewest since last October, when hurricanes disrupted job sites. and state and local governments added nearly 64,000 education jobs in June, a total that economists suspect was inflated by seasonal quirks around the end of the school year. So far this year, the economy has been generating 130,000 jobs a month, down from 168,000 jobs last year, in an average of 400,000 a month from 2021 through 2023 during the recovery from COVID-19 lockdowns. Employers are less likely to hire, but they're also not letting workers go either. Layoffs remain below pre-pandemic levels. History shows attacks on science come with a cost. Since President Donald Trump has taken office, elite Americans and academics are leaving the country. A quarter of those who responded to a recent poll said they would like to move outside the country in the next 5 years, and European countries are welcoming them. According to data released by the UK Home Office between March 2024 and March 2025, a record-breaking 6,000 U.S. citizens applied to either become British citizens or to live and work in the country indefinitely. In April, over 300 scientists applied to France's Safe Place for Science program, which promotes a safe and stimulating environment for scientists wishing to pursue their research in complete freedom. Americans are looking to emigrate for the same reasons immigrants have historically chosen to come to the U.S., political and economic anxiety and instability within their country of origin. The immigration script of the past century has been flipped, and for academics in particular, the loss of government funding has led them to seek intellectual freedom and the ability to conduct research elsewhere. While the rationale for emigration is clear, the potential consequences of their departure are not. What happens when the critical mass of middle-class educated professionals leave the country? The exits of prominent people can only have unexpected effects on a given country, embarrassing the regimes they've left, adding human capital to the places where they are welcomed. Additionally, when people emigrate, their absence consolidates power around the regimes that they left. In other words, politics becomes more reflective of the ideologies and values of those who stay. While pushing out dissenters may allow an oppressive regime to consolidate power or suit a nation's current political climate, it can have a huge cost, as America learned at the height of the Cold War. Consider the case of the brilliant Chinese scientist Qian Zixuan in the 1950s. Qian was studying at MIT and Caltech and became a full professor at both universities. He went on to co-found NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in 1939, becoming one of the top rocket science experts working for the U.S. government. The U.S. government did not view his Chinese citizenship as a national security threat because the U.S. and China were allies during World War II. The relationship changed after the war. In 1945, revolutionary leader Mao Zedong declared China a communist country. Chinese nationals living in the U.S. were suddenly seen as state enemies. A new director at JPL, where Qian was now working, reported his concerns that some of the lab members were likely communists. There was fear and suspicion due to the growing Cold War and the rise of McCarthyism. Although there was no evidence of wrongdoing by Qian, he was put under house arrest for 5 years until his deportation to China in exchange for the repatriation of American pilots captured in the Korean War. In 1955, by President Dwight D. Eisenhower's administration. Qian's politically motivated exile did little to help America's Cold War and instead greatly benefited communist China. In 1958, he became a member of the Communist Party and revived his career. Prior to his arrival, China did not have a strong rocket science program. Qian became the father of Chinese aerospace and rocketry. He developed the Dongfeng ballistic missile and the Chinese space program. U.S. Secretary of the Navy Dan A. Kimball called Qian's departure the stupidest thing this country ever did. He was no more a communist than I was, and we forced him to go. American brain drain will set the U.S. back decades in innovation and technology and vanquish America's advantage in education and other major fields. American scientists have already been ahead of the rest of the world on healthcare and technological advances like AI. Millions of people have now regarded the U.S. as a beacon of education and intellectual hope. History shows that an exodus of American academics will likely hasten a collapse of American education, not preserve it. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Up next is my conversation with Daria Minovi, Senior Analyst for the Union of Concerned Scientists.
I'm Lou Larini, and I'm pleased to welcome back Daria Minovi, Senior Analyst for the Center of Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists, who put rigorous independent science into action, developing solutions and advocating for a healthy, safe, and just future. Hey, thanks for coming on today, Daria. How you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Great. You know, the last time we spoke about 6 months ago, which seems like 6 years ago, our main topic was the damage recently appointed Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., might cause, considering his background. He has not disappointed, but that was just, I guess, the tip of the Trump administration iceberg aimed at decimating rational science in the United States, according to a recent report you co-authored, Science and Democracy Under Siege, documenting 6 months of the Trump administration's destructive actions. What did you and your colleagues discover about the effects of the current administration's policies?
Yeah, so we investigated the ways in which this administration is attacking science and scientists in our federal government. One of our key findings was that we documented over 400 attacks on science, which we define as actions, statements, or decisions that result in censoring, manipulation, or misinforming of science in the government. And to put that in perspective, that is essentially decisions that are going against the best available science or ignoring science or sidelining scientists. Like, for example, a few months ago, the administration decided to weaken standards for forever chemicals or PFAS chemicals in our drinking water that were established based on the best available science, and are weakening those standards that were put in place last year. So that's just one example of, again, over 400 that we documented in just 6 months of this administration.
Yeah, and, what are some of the other ways this destruction is being carried out? I mean, I know that they've, with DOGE and everything, they've slashed the federal workforce, and it seems like, they pushed out a lot of experts, right? Isn't that like one of the ways that they're, diminishing what we've already learned?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the main areas highlighted in our report is the loss of scientific expertise in our government. We documented a loss of employees across several science-based agencies, the Department of Health and Human Services, Department of Energy, NOAA, as well as EPA, which, just days after we released our report, EPA announced a massive reorganization and the closure of its scientific research arm, also known as the Office of Research and Development, which, in some ways our report is already outdated, which shows just the fervor and destruction that's being carried out by this administration to eliminate a huge, breadth of scientific expertise that's existed.
Yeah, and in addition to actually, firing a bunch of scientists that work directly for the federal government, the other area where, a lot of scientific research goes on and we as a country and as a human race learn a lot is through universities, they're being attacked too. How is that, affecting things?
Yeah, we also documented the impacts on biomedical research, particularly in grants awarded by the NIH or National Institutes of Health. The U.S. is the largest funder of biomedical research worldwide, and we documented that in the first 6 months of this administration, there was over a 54% decline in new grants awarded by the NIH compared to the same, 6 months over the past 9 years on average. So this is the lowest number of grants that have been awarded in a decade. That means less funding for innovative cancer treatments, less ability to detect and treat early stage disease, and less of an understanding of autoimmune disorders, among many other things.
You know, if you can think of, you know, an example of where this kind of funding, has proved to be way more beneficial than the actual dollars and cents. I mean, I know they claim that they're trying to eliminate waste and fraud, but, it seems to me finding a cure for cancer, is not a bad thing to try to do, and it does, this research does take money, right? I mean, you can't.
Yeah, absolutely. Even last week, I was talking to some scientists who have lost some of their grant funding, and one mentioned that their grant was canceled because of the word, or the term rather, clean drinking water that was flagged. So they're really cutting funding that is, there's scientific research that's seeking to answer questions that are going to improve the quality of life of Americans, and cutting funding that has to do with drinking water, or often like we've seen with a lot of health funding related to vaccines and vaccine hesitancy is being eliminated. And I mean, even funding that refers to women, for example, as a target population was canceled in many instances. And so we're seeing critical research, including just basic science research that helps lead to life-changing inventions and innovations, just being swept away. And I mean, the impacts of this are going to be felt for years to come. One colleague of mine, I think, said it really well, where she said, imagine you're in a hospital with a loved one and the doctor comes and tells you, here are options for what comes next. We are going to have fewer options because of the stifling of biomedical research that is happening right now.
Yeah, and I guess it's important to point out, too, what the federal government's role in funding this kind of research is about. Some of the most important questions, I guess, that need to be answered can't be, a dollars and cents value of it can't be calculated. So, private industry can't be depended on to, fork over the funds because they're all about profit and loss. So this is what the federal government does. But that doesn't diminish the importance of this research, right? I mean, that's kind of what we're supposed to be doing in a democracy, right?
Absolutely. A functioning democracy relies on science.
You alluded to it before, especially, as far as, RFK Jr. goes, they're not only diminishing the actual facts, but spreading disinformation or allowing disinformation to be spread in the name of the federal government, which I think is just appalling,
Yeah, absolutely. I think one other way in which we documented that in the report is the disruptions to federal advisory committees. These are expert panels that exist in the federal government where scientists and other experts, even members of the public, participate in these panels that advise the government on policy decisions. And one really alarming example of disruption there was that the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices at the CDC, which provide guidance on vaccines and, for example, the childhood vaccine schedule. And RFK pretty much removed all of the members of that advisory committee and replaced it with many anti-vaxxers, which is really concerning for people like me as a parent who relies on these recommendations for ensuring that my child is getting the right vaccines that are going to protect her health.
Yeah, and, just to clarify, too, to be sure, about the role vaccines play, especially in the childhood vaccine schedule that had all but eliminated measles until now, everybody's supposed to have, you know, their right to decide whether they want to have a vaccine or not, et cetera, et cetera. But for them to be really effective, you know, you have to reach a certain pretty high level percentage of people getting vaccinated. Otherwise, the disease just continues, right? I mean, that's just...
Yes, absolutely.
That's just basic science, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's interesting. You know, or sad, I guess, not really interesting. There are other policies though that are going to affect the population. I mean, I know one big heading, you know, in your report is how they basically, you know, offered you know, a license to pollute. To big companies by, I guess, you know, diminishing the EPA's reach. I mean, what are some other ways, and how is this, you know, having a deleterious effect on the population?
Yeah. So that is one of the, I think, most interesting and concerning findings of our report. A few months ago, the Trump administration essentially announced that over 530 polluting facilities that emit toxic air pollutants would be able to just send an email and be exempt from complying with the Clean Air Act for 2 more years. These are regulations that were strengthened over the past couple years using rigorous science and a robust public input process. That's what any of us, you know, any American hopes to do, is be able to, you know, when there's a regulation that will impact our life, that we can weigh in, submit a comment, some of the most basic ways that we can engage in our democratic processes. And the administration that just bypassed that altogether, allowing companies to just ask for an exemption with seemingly no reason provided, as far as I could tell. And we did an analysis to look at who would be impacted by that. And we found that, you know, of these 532 facilities across the country, about 9 out of 10 of them are within 5 miles of a school or a daycare, and more than 7 out of 10 of these are in marginalized communities with a large number of people of color, people with low income, or people who don't speak English as a first language. I know environmental justice is something that this administration wants to turn away from, but it is real and it is happening, and we are seeing these toxic air pollutants going to be continuing to be emitted in communities that are already overburdened. And many of them are also in Florida as well, and just also really concerning after years and years that communities and grassroots groups have spent time and energy working to, you know, just get basic regulations in place for clean air and water.
Yeah, you know, I just want to interrupt for a second and remind people just tuning in, this is WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I'm speaking with Daria Minovi, a senior analyst with the Union of Concerned Scientists. This you know, weakening of, the license to pollute, I guess, you know, and, oh, I'm sorry, you know, to get back to what you were saying, you know, about how a lot of these rules, you know, affected areas where black and brown people live. I mean, I think that goes back to their blanket effort to, you know, eliminate any regulation that had anything to do with DEI, anything that mentioned anything about DEI went away, you know, or had to be eliminated, you know, which of course, you know, caused some pretty embarrassing and stupid things, you know, that they did. Because also too, you know, and I don't know, I'd like you to comment on it. They're lazy. They aren't surgical, you know. They just, you know, have these, you know, core principles, and they'll just, like, you know, do, I guess, you know, a master search of everything and then just hit the leap. You know, I mean,
yeah,
like, that's how they're doing it, right?
Yeah, I mean, we have seen so many examples of, I guess, AI being inappropriately used in decision making. I mean, for example, there was a story in ProPublica of a research study related to mint plants being canceled because they use the word diversity for, you know, in reference to genetic diversity. There was also, of course, the Make America Healthy Again or MAHA report, which had a number of incorrect citations and, you know, citations that didn't even exist, and a lot of reporting about how that was written by AI. So it is just baffling that this is guidance that Americans look to, and seeing the way in which, you know, it's not even clear that real people are writing them is a significant concern, or making these decisions, you know, based on rigorous research.
Yeah, because actually, you know, I suppose the root of the problem is the prevailing attitude of this administration is that it seems like the facts really matter if they conflict with the core principles of the regime. So any, like mitigation of climate change can't be done mm-hmm. because climate change is a hoax. And any recognition that some Americans are more vulnerable than others is unfair DEI, et cetera. This is going in a bad direction. What do you see happening in the next 3.5 years? I mean, I'm not asking you, you know, I'm not gonna hold you to it, but I would appreciate your opinion as, you know, someone who's looked into this and studied it. I mean, you must have, you know, some idea or some guess, I guess.
I mean, I sigh because these last 6 months have been hard to even put into words. Just destruction and chaos. And real people's lives and families. I mean, I live in D.C. and seeing the impact it's had on even members of my own family who've lost their jobs because of the DOGE cuts in federal agency staffing and funding. So it hits personally for me, and it's just concerning to me to see the unchecked power grab that's happening. I mean, we're starting to see the courts starting to weigh in sometimes in favor of, you know, science and what the rule of law you think what it says. Obviously not in all cases, but the damage that this administration's causing, I fear, is going to be long-lasting. I mean, even if we have an administration change in 3.5 years, it's not like a light switch where they can just rehire a bunch of scientists and have that same level of institutional knowledge. There are so many experts who worked on issues in the government for years that took early retirements or, you know, won't be coming back afterward. And I fear that the impact that that's going to have on policymaking, on regulation in our country is going to be detrimental. And I, again, as a parent, I think about what our children are inheriting and wanting to ensure that our government is operating based on the best available science, based on policies that are going to protect people, not profits. So I fear that without Congress and the courts, you know, the balance of power operating as it's supposed to, that it's just going to get worse.
Yeah, which is really ironic because excuse me, because with the advent of AI, you know, it looked like, you know, we could, you know, there are some positives with AI. We could be entering, you know, sort of a new scientific renaissance. But then again, you know, with you know, the research universities and the research facilities within the federal government being basically hamstrung by this administration, you're absolutely right. This stuff doesn't happen overnight. And now, you know, a lot of those programs, I guess, are going to have to go back to square one, you know, when and if, hopefully, you know, some you know, rational leadership comes back.
Yeah.
So, you know, and we're seeing it now, you know, even though, you know, both state and the federal government, you know, claim the changes to policy, you know, had nothing to do with exacerbating, you know, the recent floods in Texas. Didn't cuts to FEMA, you know, make things much worse for Texans after the floods?
Yeah, you know, I haven't seen any investigations that draw a direct line between, you know, the DOGE cuts and the devastation of that flood. But yes, I think, you know, the cuts to FEMA as well as the, you know, cuts to the National Weather Service are, you know, further hamstringing these agencies from being able to predict and respond to disasters like in the future. And so, you know, seeing the devastation of the flooding in Texas is, just really scary as we're hurricane season is ramping up right now as well, and I fear that we are going to have more instances of devastating flooding and extreme weather where our, you know, federal agencies aren't going to be as equipped to be able to respond to them as they were before.
Yeah, you know, I got to agree with you, you know, even though, you know, I have not really read anything that shows a direct line between DOGE cuts and the severity of the floods in Texas. You know, one thing that was true is the Texas legislature, you know, balked on, you know, paying the money to come out with sirens. You know, mm-hmm. just have yeah. a siren warning system mm-hmm. in that area, you know, that everybody knew was flood prone, right? I mean, on the Guadalupe River, I guess.
Yeah, I did see that too.
Yeah, so, you know, and that, I guess, not to be, you know, making stuff up, but, you know, obviously the Texas legislature, you know, is kind of MAGA. That's where they're at. You know, that's what they do. That's part of their core principles too. So, you know, which have been also, you know, wrong on science, you know, for a yeah. number of reasons.
I do hope that the state does invest in additional preparedness measures after this, and that other states that, you know, have increased risk of flooding are thinking the same, because, I mean, that was absolutely devastating, and we're going to need these, you know, advanced, detection measures in place. If we're not going to have funding for FEMA and the agencies that can respond to these disasters in the least, people need to be more prepared to be able to evacuate when they have to.
Yeah, and, you know, as you know, noted, you know, I am located here in Florida, so, you know, have been watching hurricanes for many, many years, and it is always nice to get, you know, more and more exacting information about when they're coming and their intensity, but apparently, you know, because of cuts to NOAA, from what I've read, you know, that may be a thing of the past, that,
yeah,
we'll know when they're coming, but... You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, after last year, you know, with, you know, Milton in particular, you know, that started, you know, west of us, you know, and intensified in a day to a Cat 5 because the Gulf of Mexico had gone up to about 80 degrees, you know, it was like the hottest it had ever been,
mm-hmm.
you know, that kind of stuff. We aren't going to find out about that, right? Because that's pretty much against the core principle, you know, that climate change doesn't exist.
Yeah, one other that also touches on another key finding of our report too, was the sort of censorship of scientific information or removal of scientific information, particularly from federal government web pages. We've seen a number of federal databases, climate-related databases, also EJ Screen and the Climate and Economic Justice Screening Tool, among many others, removed. And these are, you know, public databases that our taxpayer dollars fund and that were just taken offline because of these, you know, executive orders around DEI. And one of our partners found that, you know, they were tracking over 4,400 federal environmental web pages and found that about 67% of them had a loss of information access, meaning that some of these web pages were removed altogether and many others, again, over two-thirds of them had information changed or removed. And that includes things like changing terms like climate change, a basic scientific term that is obviously backed up by a large body of science, changed to terms like future risk or extreme weather. And we found that a lot of these changes were taking place on web pages related to climate change and environmental justice. So that's just yet another way in which the public is going to suffer because we are not able to access the, you know, science-based information that we seek from the government. I mean, this is also the case with public health-related information at HHS.
Yeah, well, you know, on that note, you know, I need to thank you, Daria Manovi, for, you know, making time for us today. And, you know, please tell my listeners how they can, you know, learn more about what the Straight Scoop is from the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Yeah, you can check us out at ucs.org. And one of the key recommendations of our report was to support the Scientific Integrity Act, which is has been introduced in the House but not the Senate. So calling your senators and asking them to support this bill, sponsor this bill, would be great. Thank you.
Thank you. You have a great day, Daria.
You too. Bye.
Bye now.
Once again, at a cost to taxpayers, this administration would rather burn aid than distribute it to those who need it. The Trump administration is set to destroy $9.7 million worth of U.S.-purchased contraceptives rather than deliver them to women overseas following the dismantling of foreign aid assistance programs carried out by the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. The preliminary decision to destroy USAID-procured birth control was confirmed by the State Department spokesperson, who said the cost of incinerating them would be $167,000. The contraceptives have been housed in a warehouse in Geel, Belgium. The Belgian Foreign Ministry said that it was engaged in diplomatic talks with the U.S. Embassy to work to find an alternative solution for the supplies. The contraceptives are mostly long-lasting types of birth control, such as intrauterine devices, IUDs, and injectables, a U.S. congressional aide told CNN. It is not clear exactly when the supplies will be destroyed, according to the aide. They have to double incinerate the products because they contain high levels of hormones, and they don't want to risk leaking the byproducts out into the environment, which likely adds to the cost, the congressional aide said. The Trump administration is quite literally burning taxpayer money. A list of supplies shared with CNN by another source with knowledge of the warehouse stock shows that the contraceptives include copper IUDs, rod implants, birth control injections, and levigorestrol and ethyl estrogen tablets. Some have USAID branding, but the majority do not, according to the source's list. Most of the products expire in 2028 or 2029, with the earliest expiration date among the products is April 2027, according to the list, detailing the nearly 5 million items. The United States State Department spokesperson referred to the contraceptives to be destroyed as certain abortifacient birth control commodities from terminated Biden-era USAID contracts. There is controversy about whether to describe certain contraceptives as abortifacient or causing abortion due to the debate over whether life begins at the moment an egg is fertilized or at a later stage. Some birth control methods, including AIDs, may work to prevent implantation of a fertilized egg. However, IUDs primarily work by suppressing the release of eggs or by preventing sperm from reaching the egg. Only a limited number of commodities have been approved for disposal. No HIV medications or condoms are being destroyed, the spokesperson added. USAID avoided an additional $34.1 million in taxpayer costs by negotiating no-cost cancellations of pending orders placed under the Biden administration. U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaleen, a Democrat from New Hampshire, sent a staff member to a warehouse in Belgium as part of her effort to introduce legislation prohibiting the destruction of such commodities unless all efforts to sell or donate them have been exhausted. The staffer also found that the earliest expiration date for the contraceptives was 2027, with some of the supplies not expiring until 2031, meaning they could still be used for years to come. At a moment when the Trump administration has made devastating cuts to foreign assistance, it is disappointing that the State Department would sign off on spending money to actually destroy paid-for commodities that would save lives and are waiting to be deployed, Shaleen said in a statement. Food and family planning commodities are desperately needed in conflict-afflicted areas like Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo, where famine is taking hold. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WLP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Thanks to Daria Minovi from the Union of Concerned Scientists for that report. Stay tuned to Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman.